Tarnished Gold, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Former gymnast and Olympic gold medalist Dominique Moceanu suffered years of abuse from her coaches and father.
I was terrified every day I went to the gym that my coaches would threaten me that if I didn't perform well enough to their liking, that they would call my father. And it scared the bejeebies out of me.
We'll hear her story. Also, a filmmaker courts trouble with a film about Lebanon's civil war.
In Lebanon, there are certain words, if any individual say it and it gets out of hand, it could carry problems.
Plus, an airlift for dogs out of Puerto Rico.
Some of the dogs did a lot of barking on the descent, so I assume their ears were popping. but for the most part, they were great.
That and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for making it here. Today, speaking truth to power. It's a theme that you'll hear throughout the show.
You're glamorizing people who abuse children. How is that okay? And how come nobody's saying anything?
That's former Olympic gymnast Dominique Moceanu. We'll get her thoughts on the sentencing of Larry Nassar, former team doctor for U.S. women's gymnastics. Also, we'll hear from a Lebanese filmmaker who doesn't always see eye to eye with the Lebanese government and isn't afraid to say it out loud. We begin today, though, next door to Lebanon in Syria and the war, which has been grinding on for almost 8 years. Misery for millions of people, but the narrative of that war seems to be changing. One, Islamic State has almost been defeated. Two, a new flashpoint has emerged. Turkey has now moved into Syrian territory to fight Kurdish groups, which were fighting IS and which are supported by the United States. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette has been into Syria numerous times during the course of the conflict.
With every trip, there is a different feeling about Syria, about the major cities in Syria, like Damascus, where I am now, like Homs in central Syria, and Aleppo in northern Syria, two other cities I have been to on this visit. And certainly what you hear from Syrian officials, the mantra now is, look at the map. The war is over. Large parts of Syria are under our control now. So they say it's time to rebuild Syria. But the war, in reality, isn't over. There are still pockets held by the rebels, including, for example, in Damascus. We can still hear the warplanes in the sky here. So the rebels are still here. They certainly have been diminished. They certainly have no foothold now to challenge the rule of President Assad. Slowly, life is returning to what are colossal ruins, overwhelming destruction, but little bit of life in the ruins and people starting to come back and trying to put together what are literally the pieces of their lives.
So now there's this new pocket of conflict with the Kurds. Why is Turkey so concerned about Kurds inside Syria?
There are wars within wars in Syria. And the longer this conflict goes on, and it's approaching its eighth year, the more it is less about Syria. You have the Turkish invasion into a Syrian Kurdish enclave just across its border in the last week. In the last week, you've also heard the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson outlining a new Syria policy, which involves an open-ended presence for the some 2,000 American troops still in Syria, fighting, he said, the remnants of so-called Islamic State, and also, he says, staying on the ground to push back against the growing influence of Iran. And then, of course, you have Russia, the main foreign power in Syria, controlling the skies over that area and very much having a say on which way it's going to go.
And with that White House shift in policy on Syria, I mean, part of that is to assist the Kurds on the ground. How's that going to change things?
Turkey opening up a new front across the border into Syria against the Kurds. It regards the Syrian Kurds as being linked to its mortal enemy, the PKK, which it regards as a terrorist group. And it is regarded as a terrorist group by other countries. The problem is that the fighters that it is going against now, who control territory in northern Syria, are the same fighters that the United States had been using in its battle against so-called Islamic State. And so, therefore, the United States very much wants to work with the Kurds. So, in addition, you also have rising tension between two major NATO allies, the United States and Turkey. President Trump has called on Turkey not to escalate tension in the region. So, yet again, mixed messages. and a very, very messy situation on the ground.
I'm curious to know what you heard from Syrians about this proposal that a lot of people say is essentially the U.S. declaring forever war in Syria.
Well, it depends which Syrians you talk to. The Syrian government is furious. I spoke to the Syrian deputy foreign minister, Faisal Mekdad, and he called this new shift in Syrian policy an absolutely devastating mistake, another mistake, as he put it. He added that he saw it as 100% different from what President Trump had talked about in his election campaign, where basically he had said that the United States was not going to pursue the similar policy to President Obama. But President Trump had spoken about going after Islamic State. That's what Rex Tillerson says they're going to be doing with the long-term open-ended presence of troops. But Faisal Mekdad made it clear that Syria saw this as a hostile act. He threatened to take action. But, of course, he knows very well that the last thing Russia wants is escalation, any risk of confrontation with American forces on the ground in Syria.
Lise, as always, thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you.
That's the BBC's Lise Doucette in Damascus. As you heard, the war in Syria is headed into its eighth year. It's easy to lose track of how it all started. Truth is, a lot of conflicts around the world are like that. They start with something very, very small, even something personal between just two people, and then they spin out of control. That's the premise of a new film called The Insult. It's a drama set in modern-day Lebanon and has just gotten an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. Ziad Doueri is a filmmaker. He was born in Lebanon, but now has French and American citizenship. We reached him in Paris to ask him about his film.
It's basically about a silly incident, very, very insignificant between two people, between a mechanic and a plumber, that evolves into a verbal dispute. And instead of getting it resolved very quickly, it keeps getting worse and worse, and it gets to be more complicated to the point that it goes beyond their control and it goes to a tribunal and it becomes a courtroom drama. And again, it gets even more complicated. It goes to the Court of Appeal, and then it gets even more complicated. It gets to the presidency. So once it gets to the presidency, the country is on a verge of a nervous breakdown. And we discover why those two people are so much at each other's throat. It's a film about, you know, unfinished business.
Yeah, unfinished business. So this is set in the present day, but
that's it right.
Deals with the past, the 1980s, the civil war in Lebanon. What got you started with this film, and did you set out to do something about that civil war?
You know, to tell you the truth, West Beirut was about my life in the civil war. This is not about the civil war. This is about my life today.
West Beirut was your one of your previous films.
Yes, it was my first film.
Right.
And it was about growing up in the civil war in 1975. This one is about the other side. It's about, you know, 20 years later, after way after the war, way after I went to the States, worked, lived, came back to Beirut, started re-examining certain things. It's not about history. It's not about civil war. It's about those two characters. But you know how it is. You can't uncut. You can't break that umbilical cord between the present and the past.
Yeah, except I hear that in schools in Lebanon, some schools are trying to break that umbilical cord. They don't even teach the history of the Civil War because it's so contentious. So why is it still so difficult in Lebanon to talk about that war?
I think it's very difficult because there is no common idea about who is right and who is wrong. Everybody is pulling history on his side, so they can't seem to agree. As long as they don't sit with each other, sit down with each other face to face and dig up the past, you know, we won't be having a common denominator. In Lebanon, you can use certain things. There are certain words. If any individual say it and it gets out of hand, it could turn into, it could create problems. Mm. You know, when I was a child, my dad always used to tell me, yeah, be careful what you say. You know, you can't say that. You know, you talk about religion, people are going to get upset. You talk about race, people are going to get upset. You talk about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, people are going to get very upset. And this idea that my dad told me one time, because I've done something stupid a few years ago, and then I told my dad, look, this is what I've done. He says, you're crazy. You're completely out of your mind to say this. This is how war starts.
That can you tell phrase. Us what you said? What was it?
I can't say it on television, okay. on radio. I can't. It's too offensive. Not that I'm censoring myself. I just, that's it. I don't want to be jailed again. It was happened once. I don't want to go again because of things like this. So I'm sorry.
Your caution, though, about the effects that anything you say might have in Lebanon, I mean, it's well founded. At the same time your film was getting rave reviews, you returned to Lebanon and were promptly arrested. Can you just tell us what happened and what it was like being in jail for however long you were there?
Look, you know, we don't want to make this interview sensationalism because it's, you know, some people tend to think that we're creating negative publicity to attract the audience. I hate that. I did not ask for it. But since you ask, I'll give you a quick background. The whole problem started with me a few years ago when I did a film called The Attack. It's a film shot partly in Palestine and partly in Tel Aviv. Now, as a Lebanese citizen, you're not allowed to go to Tel Aviv. But I went ahead and did it because I believe that's where the film takes place. So when I came back to Lebanon, there's a group that you probably is too familiar with. It's called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Group. Mm-hmm. They are very active in Lebanon. And then started campaigning against the film, accusing me of being, you know, just because I set a camera in Tel Aviv, they say he's an Israeli collaborator. And they said, you know, he wants normalization with Israel where their goal is different. And I said, no, guys, don't start labeling me. I just want to do the movie. But they kept on doing that campaign on my previous film. Then finally, the government was convinced to ban it. And then 22 Arab countries banned it. I was pissed. I was pissed as hell. Like, I just did a movie. I'm not collaborating. I'm not spying. I'm not dealing. I just took a camera, worked, shot it there. A few years later, I go in 2017, I do a film called The Insult. So the government again was Saad Hariri, who was really fantastic. He said, look, this film represents us. This film is legitimate and we love the movie. We're going to send it to the Oscar. So finally, we won the Venice Award for Best Actor. And on the way back to Beirut, was very happy with the prize. Very, very happy. Mm. And then the BDS had filed a complaint with the Lebanese army saying that Ziad Douairi is in violation of the law. And I was. And I knew it. But that was the old story. So I was taken into custody. And then I was taken to a military tribunal. And then the judge there looked at the whole case. And then, frankly, he just did not want to get into this mess, especially that I'm a U.S. citizen, I'm a French citizen. So it would have caused a little of a diplomatic incident, and, Lebanese government had other things to worry about. So I was acquitted. And I was upset, to be very honest. I was a bit scared because I have a daughter, and I don't want to be arrested for a film. You know, I think they have the whole right, the BDS, to hate the movie or to not see the movie, but you can't force other people not to see it.
It's a weird one, though, isn't it? Because it's a sign of recognition for Lebanon when your film, The Insult, gets a nod at Venice, gets an Oscar nomination, and then the government in Lebanon has this long list of banned films. What do you make of this contradiction?
Lebanon is a country of contradiction and paradox. You put the right finger on the word. That's it. You use the right word. Lebanon is torn between two different movement in Lebanon. There are people who just don't believe that we should boycott stuff. We should let freedom of speech and freedom of information and freedom of movie makers and writers and novelists and theater players to be. And there are people who believe that, no, there are red lines you can't cross. This has been an ongoing battle for a long time. The fact that I went to Israel is not a sign that I agree with the occupation. There is an Israeli occupation, and it's extremely unjust. I understand that. But then if you want to fight the battle, go fight against the occupiers. Don't fight against people who take a tripod and stick it in Tel Aviv and shoot there. I think it's just a silly thing. Just because I took the camera and I was curious about the other side does not make you a traitor, does not make you a collaborator. It's not right.
Filmmaker Ziad Douairi, it's great to speak with you. I can't wait to see The Insult.
Thank you. It's out in the States right now.
Just ahead on the show, kids in the Galapagos Islands tackle climate change. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. For the last couple of days here on the show, you've been hearing stories of kids whose health is being affected by climate change and the growing number of extreme weather events. Millions of kids around the world are facing huge challenges from a crisis they had no role in creating. But kids aren't just victims of climate change. They're also getting involved in the fight against it. That's why we're meeting some of them this week. Kids who are learning about climate change and taking action however they can. Today from our Livable Planet desk, reporter Tipa Fernandez introduces us to a group of high school students on the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador.
Have you ever heard a giant land tortoise breathe? It was a first for these teens too. even though they've lived their entire lives right here in the famous Enchanted Islands, where tortoises roam quite freely. They're students from Casares High School on the island of Santa Cruz, but this week they're up in the highlands on a project with an NGO called EPI, Ecology Project International, learning how to track, weigh, and count tortoises. That beep was a tiny machine registering that this tortoise has never been tracked before. No tiny little chip in him. So the students, under the careful watch of a national park ranger, will implant one. EPI scientist Maria Fernanda Ceballos goes over the procedure. It's no academic exercise. Her colleague, Andres Holguín, asked the students why it's important to study tortoise ecology. So they don't become extinct, says 16-year-old Sissy Sanchez-Barron. And while there are lots of threats to the giant Galapagos tortoise species, the changing climate is a big one, she says.
Last year was a terrible catastrophe. There was a drought and all the grasses, they dried up.
She's right, says National Park Ranger Roberto Jimenez.
The fields had been so dry, it was almost a whole year without food for the tortoises, and they lost a lot of weight.
These kids are amazing.
Andres Holguín has led classes like this in the Galapagos for years.
They come here, they learn about so many threats to the environment, and then at the end of the course, they have this change in behavior, in attitude that is just, it gives me hope.
Okay, so that was when they were all hanging out with the tortoises up in the highlands, camping out, having a real natural world adventure. But how does their eco-consciousness last back in the real world? A couple weeks later, I visited the students at school. They were all formally dressed in their tunics, but seemed so different from the serious teenagers out in the forest with the tortoises. They're loud,
Madrina.
Flirtatious, vying for each other's attention.
A ver, chicos, tomen asiento. Buenos días.
Science teacher Martha Naranjo Criollo settles her class.
¿Qué es el cambio climático para ustedes? ¿Qué entienden por esa palabra?
And then she launches right in, reviewing the theme of climate change, pushing for what the students know. Varying temperatures, says one. The students are a week into a project on gases like CO2. Right now, they're using vinegar, baking soda, and balloons to see how chemical reactions can produce gases. After 6 days, the balloons have inflated.
¿Por qué está el globo inflado?
Criollo asks her students why they think it happened. It's the gases, they say, and it's kind of an aha moment for the students. Criollo makes the link to greenhouse gases and what can happen when they escape into the atmosphere. And it's recess time. It's now been 2 weeks since some of these students were up in the highlands doing their tortoise conservation work. And back in the schoolyard, they're plotting. Remember 16-year-old Sissy Sanchez? She's telling her friends that to get the authorities to take them seriously, they should become an official club. Another student says they should also try to get the National Park and the Charles Darwin Foundation to support them. It's not a far-fetched idea. Students here have regular contact with the Galapagos National Park officials.
Hola.
People like Jonathan Romero, who runs the park's educational programs. Romero says the education work they do in schools has recently taken on a new focus.
Uno de los temas principales que estamos iniciando a trabajar es el cambio climático.
They now pay a lot more attention to climate change. And they start young. Four- and five-year-olds get basic climate education too, Romero says. Park educators take students up to the highlands and even out to the volcanoes to see how the landscape has changed. Definitely way cooler than sitting at a desk all day. And it really does seem to be taking hold. Just before I left the Galapagos, I went to Tortuga Bay on Santa Cruz Island and found some youth hard at work. It's a 45-minute hike from the nearest parking lot. By the time you reach the ocean, you're ready to leap right in. Tourists and locals alike make good use of this beach. But amidst the bikinis and beach balls, there's a group of teens hard at work. 17-year-old Camila Leon is on her tippy toes trying to tie a piece of string to a pole wedged into the sand. She's midway through a year-long study of beach erosion.
La metodología de esto es ubicar...
She's learning under the guidance of Ecology Project International trainers and national park experts. They stick a pole in the sand, tie a string to it, and take it up the beach to the sand dune, and then measure.
29 metros.
Helping her is Alberto Proaño, a marine technician who's been doing this sand level analysis for years, mostly for one main reason.
Los nidos que ya están puestos.
Turtle nests. If there is less sand, the turtles can't bury their eggs. And fewer eggs over time can be a straight line to extinction. Climate change is causing sea levels to rise and make storms more intense. That means more coastal erosion worldwide. And maybe even right here at Tortuga Bay.
Bueno, es algo normal que un perfil de playa cambie.
Well, it's normal that the sand levels change, but these last few years the changes have been really abrupt.
Proaño says that in previous decades, natural cycles took away the sand and brought it back. But these last few years, it's just been decreasing.
Aquí tenemos un cambio.
Today, Camila notes a change in the level of the sand at the dune. Her careful measurements will be entered into a database, which will help the national park get a fix on what's going on this beach. And after 6 months of collecting data here, she's pretty sure she sees a trend.
Yo pienso que sí se está erosionando la playa.
I think the beach is eroding, she tells me. It can't be easy to see this, especially for someone so young, who grew up on these islands. But Camila says she's planning to keep working on the beach project because the turtles are worth it.
I've always liked and been fascinated by these animals because they have survived so long through the ages. But there's just a lot less of them because they're in danger of extinction.
Camila knows that she and her schoolmates didn't cause the climate change that's threatening the turtles' habitat. But she's serious about wanting to fight its impacts and be part of a solution. And it's a determination that's taking hold among other young people here on one of nature's most spectacular creations. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, the Galapagos Islands.
Deepa's reporting was supported by the Atlas Family Foundation. Tomorrow she heads to Florida to meet a 10-year-old who's suing the U.S. government over climate change. Catch the whole series on Kids and Climate at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Dominique Mocianu won Olympic gold in gymnastics, but getting there, she says, meant years of abuse from her coaches.
Screaming and belittling and body shaming and neglecting you. If you made a mistake, oh my goodness, it was because you were fat and you were a worthless piece of garbage.
Her story, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston.
Sir, I'm giving you 175 years, which is 2,100 months. I've just signed your death warrant.
That was Judge Rosemary Aquilina in a Michigan courtroom yesterday. She was sentencing Larry Nassar, the former doctor for the U.S. women's gymnastics team. More than 150 young women had recently come forward to detail Nassar's serial sexual abuse. Many of them, including prominent Olympic athletes, appeared in court to recount what Nassar put them through. Jasmine Garz is the World's Women's Lives correspondent and joins me now. So, Jasmine, you're about to speak with Dominique Mocianu. Remind us who Mocianu is and why you wanted to speak specifically with her.
Dominique Mocianu is a star in the world of gymnastics. At age 14, she became the youngest person to win a U.S. gymnastics gold medal. She was hailed as this hero in the 90s. She was the girl every little girl looked up to, including me. I was a gymnast from age 5 to 16, and Dominique Mocianu was my hero. She was my goal. And then, you know, several years later, she came out and was really vocal about the verbal and physical and emotional abuse she suffered at the hands of her coaches, Marta and Bella Caroli. And her father as well was extremely abusive to further her career as a gymnast. And she emancipated from her father eventually. So I really wanted to catch up with her as kind of like a pioneer of calling abuse out and ask her, what is going through your mind right now?
I am so proud of the courageous women who've come forward because it took that many women have come forward to finally show, unfortunately, the horrific acts that have taken place and that have gone unregistered and unnoticed for so long. When I first started speaking out, the former president of USA Gymnastics, he tried to assassinate my character, make me a liar, belittle me, treat me like I was a worthless person. And I was so disgusted by his behavior and the facade that they all put on television and this, oh, this greater than life Carolis and the ranch and all of that. And I said, it's all a lie. That is not who they are. You're glamorizing people who abuse children. How is that okay? And how come nobody's saying anything? Because all they cared about is they were winning. So nobody was asking questions. And everyone kept saying, oh, well, their success is proved. It's proved because the medals. And it just became so normalized. That's the scary part. And then it allowed someone like a Nassar to breed in this toxic environment and have unprecedented access to children.
Has anyone reached out to you since to say, hey, I'm sorry I didn't take that more seriously?
Nobody has said those words, believe it or not, to me. And that's what was most disappointing in the last decade, is that not one teammate came publicly forward. Maybe some friends of mine and some of the gymnasts I train with. I felt at a very low point about a year and a half ago. And I started to pray about it and I said, is it all worth it? Nobody is listening. Nobody is wanting to make changes.
What was going on with these coaches? I mean, for listeners who don't know, what was going on?
Of screaming and belittling and body shaming and making you feel worthless and neglecting you. If you made a mistake, oh my goodness, it was because you were fat and you were a worthless piece of garbage. That's how they treated you. They chose to ignore you the rest of the time so they can prove they're more powerful than you. At the Olympics, before I received my gold medal, I was crying because I felt like a disappointment to Marta and Bella because of how they made me feel after my vault, when mathematically my vault actually won it for the team.
I remember seeing you and I admired what you did, but you also looked incredibly sullen for a 14-year-old. And after you won your Olympic gold medal, did you get to celebrate?
So there was a team celebration that was at Planet Hollywood. Bruce and Demi Moore through like this surprise party, and there was media there and stuff. I was just happy to eat. Honestly, we hadn't eaten since 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right before we went to, you know, the warm-up practice and then go compete. And so really we didn't have food till 10:30 at night after the competition. And I just felt, I don't know, I worked all these years and I said, is this what it's really supposed to feel like? I felt empty and I felt saddened because I wasn't good enough. I wasn't perfect enough. And here I was, a 14-year-old. This was my dream for the last 11 years of my life. I spent 40-plus hours in the gym. I sacrificed so much. I had very few friends. And I did it for this. I felt like it should have felt better, more fulfilling.
Do you worry that now what it's going to be is, oh, we caught the monster, problem solved? I mean, do you worry that the bigger cultural picture that enabled Nassar is not going to get addressed?
I do believe that change will happen and is starting to happen. We've already seen 3 board members resign. USA Gymnastics cut ties with the Caroli Ranch as a national team training center. We've seen Debbie Van Horn, the trainer, was also fired. We've seen MSU president fired. I mean, there are finally actions being taken. And I told that to the president who spoke to me almost a month ago. And I told her, I said, if you want any credibility within our industry, you absolutely have to start making some drastic changes. We have been waiting long enough. Our community is fed up. People have been sounding the alarms for a long time. And I've been very vocal for 10 years and felt very much at a low point about a year and a half ago until all this stuff came forward, until the women told me about Nassar. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't leave you alone in this. I have to help you.
I think something that gets left out of the conversation is money and the balance of power. USA Gymnastics pulls in so much money. And unlike any other professional athletes, gymnasts make little to no money.
And I don't think a lot of people realize that because they see you on the cereal box or, you know, the commercial and they think, oh, gymnasts make a ton of money. They're famous. There's a huge power imbalance between the athletes and the organization. Do you think the money issue needs to be addressed here?
Oh, absolutely. And I've said that with people who are throwing around the idea of starting a competing organization because that has been talked about for years. And I said, okay, well, if you're going to do that, remember, our athletes don't have any pension when they leave this sport. They go out into the world broke after they've given 20, 25 years of their life to the sport. They need to have better stipends and they need to have a Bill of Rights, some kind of a protection for them and to know what their rights are. Do you know nobody ever read us any kind of rights? That's why we felt we didn't have any.
Dominique, I want to end our conversation on a positive note because I love this sport and I know you love it too.
Definitely.
Something really beautiful that you always talk about is learning to fall back in love with the sport after the Olympics. And I think that's something that fans of the sport are going to have to do after all this. They're going to have to fall back in love with it and find reasons to fall back in love with it. Was there a precise instant that you can describe after you left the Karolis, you left the Olympics? Was there an aha moment where you realized, I love gymnastics?
You know, I always love gymnastics because of how it makes you feel and running and jumping and flying through the air and twisting and flipping and all of that. It was the adults that created it to be twisted and warped. The aha moment was when I was obviously a child and loved the sport for its purity and my innocence. And I could excel and be very good at it and possibly go to the Olympics. I loved it as a child. I love it to this day. My children enjoy it. My son actually really has potential to go far. And that's why there's so many things that are going to change to better the future for not only my children, but everyone's children. And that's what I fought so hard for all the last, you know, 10 years. And so there is one aha moment post all of this that I've come forward. And honestly, in the courtroom, just a couple days ago where I sat and supported the brave women that have come forward, I felt more love and support than I ever have at any USA Gymnastics event in the last 10 years.
Dominique, I want to thank you so much as a woman and as a former gymnast for talking about what happened. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jasmine, I got to say, that was a totally riveting conversation. Let me just start by asking you, as our women's lives correspondent and a former gymnast who's seen this whole world up close, what struck you about what Dominique was saying?
Well, I think what struck me is the very accurate perception of a world in which adults are in it for a lot of reasons, and some of them, you know, it's almost like the child actor conundrum. I mean, there's just a lot of adults around you who are in it for the money, who are in it to live vicariously, who are in it for the glory, in the case of Dr. Nasser, for some very dark and twisted reasons, and that there needs to be some system in which someone, a third party, jumps in and says, is this kid okay?
So let me follow up on the big question that these abuse scandals keep on opening up. And that question is, how could this happen? Mochiano pointed out that the U.S. team had this tradition of winning, and winning essentially eclipsed the abuse. If the U.S. had been losing, do you really think Nasser would have been facing a judge sooner?
Honestly, I think, yeah, there's a culture of follow the money. You know, like these wins bring in tremendous endorsements and prestige. And I think, you know, for a predator like Nasser, they thrive off hiding behind the cloak of prestige, of befriending parents, of being valued members of the community. And what's behind it is very dark.
Mochiano also expressed some resentment that her own teammates didn't speak out. How much is that internal silence still a problem?
I think in my experience, both as a journalist and as a former gymnast, when you have an environment that is abusive, one of the strategies of abusers is to turn their victims against themselves and isolated in their shame, isolated by psychological manipulation. You know, when I was a kid doing gymnastics, I was a gymnast from age 5 to 16.
there was very much a competitiveness that went beyond what was healthy.
There was this moment in your interview with Mochianu where I just thought, you know, we put so much on young Olympic athletes, and there are parents who bring that pressure even earlier in their kids' lives. You know, when there's gold and those kids end up on the box of Wheaties, we see the glory. But to hear Dominique's story of emptiness, to hear the other stories of those women in the courtroom in Michigan, I mean, bottom line, it doesn't sound like fun. It doesn't sound like the life of champions. Frankly, it sounds like torture. Can you explain why any parent knowing this would want to introduce their kids to this potentially traumatizing sport?
Well, I think I want to be really careful not to blame parents for what happened, because parents are as much the victims of Dr. Nassar as the children. And I think for a lot of kids, this is a really fun sport. I mean, listen, very few people are going to go to the Olympics. Very few people will go past, you know, having some fun with it in high school and in middle school. You know, I think there is a lot of dreams, there's a lot of glory, there's a lot of prestige, and you fall in love with the sport. It's so graceful, and it's so beautiful, and elegant, and difficult, and challenging.
I was also intrigued that Mochianu thought pretty firmly that the Nassar sentence and case it will change things. I know you spoke with a law professor. What's his take?
Yeah, I went to Baruch College here in New York, where Professor Mark Edelman teaches. He specializes in law, in sports law. And he told me gymnasts need to unionize. And you know, what he was saying is, if you take the major sports in America, football, baseball, basketball, hockey, they are all on a professional level unionized. And he was saying gymnasts and ice skaters are at the biggest disadvantage because they start so young. We're talking about 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds with no bargaining power. And what Professor Edelman said is, if we do not address the structural problems, perhaps unionize, this is going to happen again.
A reasonable union might try to impose some type of review of people that are providing services to the athletes. They might create internally a form of whistleblower protection to allow athletes to bring complaints directly to them. The union would have the duty to investigate these complaints, as well as perhaps provide the athlete with the legal costs to seek attorneys, to seek psychological help, and to make sure these individuals are removed.
Jasmine, do you think that could work?
I think it's better than nothing. I mean, right now, I think gymnasts are at an egregious disadvantage in the world of sports.
Jasmine Garz, our Crosswinds Lives correspondent. That was really powerful stuff, Jasmine. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco.
It has been 4 months since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. It knocked the island's entire power grid offline and left most people in the dark, American citizens in the dark. And still, today, more than a third of the island's electric customers are without power. And this week, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, announced plans to privatize the island's electric utility. Kate Aronoff has been following the story for The Intercept. Thanks for being here, Kate. Governor Rosselló made this announcement that he plans to sell off PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. That happened during a televised address on Monday. What exactly did he say?
So he announced that over an 18-month process, he will first move to establish the legal groundwork for privatization by passing a law through Puerto Rico's legislature. Once that's done, he'll still open up the bidding process to anyone who might want to buy specifically the generation capacity of the island. So things like plants and natural gas facilities, any renewable power that's online, things like that. And then plans for the transmission and distribution part of the system will be brought under sort of a private operator.
So PREPA is in a bit of a mess right now, safe to say. It's got a lot of troubles, but it wasn't in the best shape before Hurricane Maria, right?
No, not at all. And it's really suffered from sort of decades of real disinvestment.
I mean, given all these troubles PREPA has, who would actually want to buy it or any of its pieces?
Right. This is a big question. From what I can tell and from people I've talked to, one thing that people are sort of speculating about is whether private equity would actually want to come in and buy it, make money for a few years, sort of condense operating expenses, and then sell it off. So exactly where PREPA ratepayers fit into that, nobody really knows.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, let's say some version of this privatization happens. How will Puerto Ricans be affected by this? Could it raise rates?
It could raise rates, and especially if the Puerto Rican Energy Commission is dismantled. About 2 weeks before Rosselló announced that he wanted to privatize PREPA, his office also announced that they hope to essentially liquidate that regulator. So there will essentially be no check on private operators coming in and raising rates to whatever they want. And that's, you know, one of the main differences between a private utility and a public utility is that a public utility has an obligation to provide a service to as many people as possible within a certain area and make sure that people are actually getting that service, where a private company is essentially responsible to its shareholders. And so they have a different set of incentives, and that doesn't always necessarily align with everyone getting power.
So as I look at reports about how Puerto Ricans are responding to this privatization news, it seems they think any change at this point would be welcome. But it also looks like they're kind of wary. What are you hearing?
Right. So, you know, I think everyone virtually agrees that PREPA has not been run very well for a long time and is not meeting the needs of Puerto Ricans, but that the overwhelming problems with PREPA will remain even if it's privatized, especially, again, if the Puerto Rican Energy Commission is dissolved, which had created one of the island's first plans for really concertedly transitioning to more affordable renewable power.
Kate Aronoff there from The Intercept. And a final note today from Puerto Rico, a poignant but hopeful one. Last weekend, a flight full of volunteers landed in San Juan. They were carrying about 14,000 pounds of supplies for the island. And the return flight also had a special mission, transporting homeless cats and dogs from Puerto Rico to a shelter in the Washington, D.C. area. The volunteers took their 62 canine and feline charges to Lucky Dog Animal Rescue. Mira Horowitz is the executive director there, and she was one of the volunteers on board.
The cats in particular weren't thrilled about takeoff. And some of the dogs, right? And some of the dogs did a lot of barking on the descent, so I assume their ears were popping. but for the most part, they were great. We flew down and we had not just the supplies we were leaving on the island, but we had all of the crates and cat carriers on the plane with us, and they had to be put together. Then the animals had to be loaded in, driven through security onto the tarmac, and then we had to load them into the plane. The animals rode in the cabin of the plane, so the crates were seat belted into each row. We had a massive team of volunteers, Lucky Dog volunteers, Puerto Rican volunteers, and Southwest Airlines cargo volunteers. And the whole thing only took 2.5 hours.
So of these 62 dogs and cats that you brought back from Puerto Rico, how many were strays and how many were, you know, just animals that people could no longer take care of because of the situation down there?
So I don't have exact numbers, but I can give you some examples. So 3 of the dogs on the flight are what we think purebred Scottish Terriers, and their owners tied them to a chain link fence outside a very busy intersection in the week following Maria and never came back for them.
Wow.
One of the rescuers found them. They were in very rough condition by the time this rescuer came upon them. There are others on the flight that were puppies that were born in the immediate aftermath of the hurricane. So we heard a lot of stories about finding animals in abandoned homes. There were many that were picked up as strays in the aftermath of the hurricane. And then there were a handful of dogs that had been in foster care even prior to the hurricane. I've read stories about people that have left animals with friends and then just never came back for them. Part of the real problem was in the immediate aftermath of the hurricane, when they finally got normalized flight operations happening for people, the government wouldn't let animals be put in cargo. And so they didn't have a choice. Some people had to leave and they didn't have a choice.
You know, I was wondering, what do you say to people who question whether we should be focusing on animals when there are so many humans suffering on the island?
You know, it's a legitimate question, but what I would say is that animals touch humans and animals are part of our humanity. With respect to the people who are still on the island, those are their family members. And for them to see their dog or cat suffer hurts them. So to say that we should focus on humans and not on animals, I think you miss the connection between the two and the fact that by helping animals, you are more than helping people at the same time. They've also improved the lives of the rescuers because it's a life that they no longer have to worry about. They're not going to suffer again, and I can move on to the next challenge. But watching the rescuers put the animals into the crates and having them say goodbye is just so emotional. And they know they're doing the right thing, and they know these animals are going to have fabulous homes, but it's hard for them. And it's a little hard to watch as well. So we try our best to give them as many updates as possible.
Mira Horowitz, Executive Director of Lucky Dog Animal Rescue in the Washington area. Mira, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Do we have adorable pictures of some of those rescued pets? Hey, what else is the internet for? Cuteness happening right now on our Instagram at PRI The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.